Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Another edition of Inside Boxing Live is here. Dan Canova, your host, as always. And we got a fun one planned for you today. We got a guest. We're keeping up with this Legends theme here on Inside Boxing Live. We had Roy Jones. We've had Bernard Hopkins. And we're ending it, saving the best for last. I might be biased here. He is a guy that has been around the sport for a very long time. He is the owner and inventor of CompuBox. He is my father. Bob Canova is here this week for some really, really fun stories about how CompuBox came to be, the evolution of the service, some great stories about the Four Kings in the 80s, Hagler Hearns, Mike Tyson, you name it. Bob Canova was there. He has been a big part of the boxing landscape, not really someone who's out in the forefront. He's a humble guy. He likes to stay in the background, you know, provide the service for these networks of the last 37 years. And but he deserves his just due and has some great stories. So I'm really excited to have Bob Canova. Do I call him dad? I've got to figure that out. I'm excited to have Bob on the show this week to talk some stories and then also talk about the current day, too, because he has seen it all. But this upcoming week, another slow week in the boxing world, there's an ESPN card. We're going to see Ilunga Makabu finally fight at cruiserweight. And of course, the WBA fiasco with the heavyweight title with Trevor Bryan and Jonathan Guidry. It's a Don King card. That's a separate pay-per-view. Another slow week. We're getting to the end of January. Now we're going to head into February where we see Keith Thurman and Mario Barrios. I'm excited for that. I'm a big Keith Thurman fan. You can say what you want about the guy, but he moves the needle. We're going to see what Keith Thurman has, because I believe if he wins, a fight with Crawford is looking more and more likely, but he has to get past Barrios. Didn't look that great all the way. Hasn't fought. I mean, we saw this past weekend with Gary Russell. Inactivity is a killer. You can't take 2 years off like Gary Russell Jr. did when he lost to Mark Bexago. You can't take 2 years off like Keith Thurman has done, hasn't fought since the Pacquiao fight, and expect to still fight at the top level. I don't know how you guys rate Mario Barrios. He's no slouch. You know, he's a top 10 type of guy. I know it's his first fight at 147, but we're going to see what Keith has. Father time waits for no one. It clearly affected Gary Russell. I know he had a lot of things going on outside of the ring with his family life, but you can't deny an aging guy over 30, inactive, shoulder injury pops up, re-aggravates it in a fight, doesn't throw a jab from the fifth round on, and nearly beats Mark Magsayo. That was a heck of a fight. A heck of a card over on Showtime. It's just some quirky things with referee Eddie Claudio, who missed a knockdown in that Lucas fight versus King Tug. Are we going to get replay in boxing? Like, what's the story? Some states have it, some states don't. We're in 2022, and a sport not having replay it's archaic. But I'm not shocked at all, because this is boxing where you would think like common sense should prevail, but it didn't. That was this past weekend over on Showtime. Some good stuff. Mark Magsayo, new champion at featherweight. I don't rate him that highly as a champion. I thought he could have really exposed Russell. Russell almost won that fight with one arm. You got to give him some props, grit, determination. I know he has a lot of detractors, Gary Russell, but you know, it's not exactly the worst thing to see the title change hands, knowing how inactive Russell is. And now he's going to be sidelined with that shoulder injury. Some other news in boxing this past week, Shakur Stevenson and Oscar Valdez reportedly have both signed on the dotted line for a unification bout at 130 pounds, which is going to be a heck of a fight. It goes up to the top of my can't miss fights of the year early on so far. And they're looking at April 30th. For that date. Like I said, it's a two belt unification. Stevenson coming off of that big win over Jamel Herring, and Valdez had an up and down year last year. He had the biggest win over Burchelt, where that was a coming out party for him. And he followed it up with the PED saga and then a lackluster performance against Robson Conceição, who fights also this weekend on ESPN. I love that ESPN is putting this fight on regular cable. You know, that keeps with their commitment of getting away from pay-per-view and putting fights back on regular ESPN. So I expect to get a huge rating. And the story of this fight is going to be the defense of Stevenson and if Valdez is going to be able to land one of his patented hooks on Shakur Stevenson. Stevenson's one of the best defenders in all of boxing, only getting hit with 4.7 punches per round, 12% of his opponents. That's the landing on Stevenson. Keep in mind, the average at 130 is 16.4 punches landed per round and 28%. That just shows you how good Stevenson is. But Valdez has also improved his defense. As we knew from Valdez coming up the ranks, he was a brawler. Remember those fights where he broke his jaw and he was out for a while? He had always had the reputation of being more of a brawler and being more of a fan-friendly fighter. But ever since linking up with Eddie Reynoso and Valdez, as he's seen his defensive metrics go up, you know, he's only getting hit with 17%. That's Valdez since linking up with Eddie Reynoso, five or six fights. So it's going to be more of a chess match, I think. If you're looking for a brawl, it's not going to be that type of fight. It's going to be an exciting fight because I think Stevenson, anytime he steps in the ring now, especially coming off of that Herring fight where his offense was on point. I can't wait for this one. I think it's a can't miss fight of the year. And it just so happens to fall on the same date that we're thinking we're going to get the Katie Taylor, Amanda Serrano fight. I mean, that's just boxing, right? If you're a boxing fan over the last 4 years, since the proliferation of all these platforms, we have dueling cards a lot. It's a shame that if these fights do end up on the same card or the same night, hopefully that they don't go up against each other in terms of the fights going off. Hopefully one starts before the other, but that's going to be a great night at MSG. If we get Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano, it's the biggest fight in women's history. It will be a celebration of women's boxing and what's coming off of a great year they had in 2021. It's a really good fight too. And then also it's April 30th, is 1 week before Cinco de Mayo. And as we know, it's Canelo Alvarez fight weekend. Who is he going to choose? Time is ticking for him to choose his opponent. Is it going to be Charlo? Is it going to be Jake Paul? That's a rumor. Or is it going to be Makabu, who fights this week over a weekend in Warren, Ohio on that Don King card? So a lot of things going on in boxing. We're getting through January. We're looking forward to February. But let's get into our interview this week. Here he is, the creator of CompuBox, Bob Canobia. All right, it's time to bring in our guest this week on Inside Boxing Live. We're keeping up with the legend theme. He is a legend in our household, the Canobia house, and he's also a legend in the sport of boxing. He's been in it for close to 40 years. Don't mean to age him. He is Bob Canobia. He happens to be my father. Happens to be my boss, happens to be a grandfather. Now I'm aging you for sure, but Bob is here and I'm excited to talk about the history of CompuBox and some other things that are going on in the sport. How's it going, Bob?
It's going good, Dan. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be mentioned in the same breath as some of those legends that you've had on the last couple of weeks. Roy Jones, Bernard Hopkins. I mean, that's a long list. So just to be, mentioned in that same breath is an honor. This is our 37th year, actually.
Wow. So CompuBox outdates me.
That's correct. Yeah. So that's, 37 that's, years.
That's crazy. Yeah. I was on that Space Chicken Talk on Twitter this past week. Shout out to Chicken Talk. They do a great job, illuminating some of the voices in boxing. And it was like a 2-hour Q&A talking about our company, talking about what we do. And I thought it was awesome that there were so many fans that were interested. The questions were great. And I didn't mind answering them because I'm more active on Twitter than say you are. But, in the back of my mind, I was just thinking, like, you're the one that should be on here. You know, you're the one with the stories. You're the one that's seen almost every punch thrown and landed since like the 80s, which is crazy to me. So we've done this before, but we haven't done it in a while. So let's go all the way back to 1985. Please share with us the story about how you came up with the idea, how it became, how the wheels got turning, and then we'll go from there.
Well, it all started back in New Jersey, a place called Sports Information Database. Mm-hmm. Logan Hobson, who was my partner up until 2003, and I were hired by this database to be boxing editors. The idea was to bring these portable computers, which were just becoming popular back then, these 40-pound machines, was the idea was to bring them to venues, access data, access research from the database, and also use the computer, obviously, to record whatever live event you were covering. So we were there one afternoon, some guy came in with a tennis program. Mm-hmm. He had written a program. He had gone to the U.S. Open and created what we would call a box score for tennis. And I'm sitting there with Logan, and I'm like, we could do this for boxing. We obviously love boxing. We hated driving to New Jersey, Hasbrook Heights, New Jersey, from Long Island. I remember saying to him, we got to get out of this place. Something, I love the job, but there's something better out there. One thing led to another. We got the idea for the program. We had a program written while we were at the database, brought it to Atlantic City for an off-TV show, checked out the numbers, make sure the program was working correctly. And then we took it to MSG, who were doing shows, asked if we could use our new product on their show. They liked it, recorded it, and we then took it to HBO. And
oh, wow. I didn't know that you actually had something to show Ross Greenberg, who we'll get to in a second, who was at the time a producer. Everyone probably knows him as the HBO sports president for about 15 years, or maybe even more. But he was a guy, like I said, on Chicken Talk, he was like an innovator. He was a guy, the first one to put, you know, sound in the corners, first person to introduce the, judging, unofficial judges. But I didn't know that you actually showed something to Ross. So how did that interview, or how did that pitch, I guess, meeting come
about? Well, what happened was, like I said, we went to the Garden. They were doing monthly shows. Mm-hmm. And we went to John Condon, who was then the voice of the Garden. I didn't really know him. I only had known him from seeing him at the shows. And we said, we have this new punch counting program. Would you mind if we tried it, displayed it tonight? And back in those days, you had the VCR. Yeah. So I had mom record the show. I said, at 9 o'clock, please push record.
I'm surprised she was able to do that.
She did it, man. She did it. Recorded the show. We actually took the VCR, the tape. Yeah. One of the big old tapes to Ross, popped it in his VCR.
Like a VHS?
Yeah. VHS, yeah.
Oh, my God.
And that's how we displayed it. It was one thing to talk about the product, but mm-hmm. to be able to show, they popped a few graphics in. Ross liked it on the spot. It was crazy. He asked us a few questions like, well, how does it work? You take one fighter each? And we said, yeah, that's probably the best way to do it. And then his wheels were already turned in. You know, he did, yes, like you said, HBO had no commercials between rounds. So it was a perfect vehicle to use something like this where, you know, and go to the corners were mic'd, and then boom, pop a stat in. So it was pretty much, you know, right place at the right time, all of the above. It just, everything just, you know, just clicked. I remember walking out of the meeting with Logan because Ross said, okay, this looks good. Flo, who's the secretary, will be in touch with you. You guys are going to Reno, Nevada next month. This was January of 85. He goes, you're going to Reno next month for Bramble Mancini rematch. Well, we walk out of the office and I remember looking at him like, we're in business. It happened that fast.
That reminds me of that Seinfeld episode where Jerry and George pitch their episode or their idea, their pilot, and then NBC buys it. And then they like look at each other like, now what?
Yeah. Okay, now, yeah, we better catch up on Bramble and Mancini, which we did. Of course, that's where we got the idea to look at. We looked at the first fight. Mm-hmm. We counted the first fight. Those numbers are probably, I think, were used on a graphic.
No, they were
on our first show.
Yeah, so, I just watched it. They were used, and Larry Merchant talked over it. The first, it was Larry and Barry Tompkins, and Barry said, "We're introducing a new gizmo," and then Larry called it a computer toy, and then they showed the first stats, which was probably perfect in hindsight, like having a rematch. is perfect for, you know, now obviously 37 years later, we love rematches because we're able to show stats from the first fight. We're able to compare, we're able to see if their pace is the same. So talk, it goes in line or the same theme, like you said, like right place, right time, everything coming into the right place. But that's nuts for Greenberg to buy it, or pretty much buy it on the spot. It's just kind of goes in line with who he was, you know, like an innovator, someone that was willing to take these chances, someone that was looking ahead. You know, I know that we saw him, the last time I saw him was at that final HBO dinner, which was that really a sad night in reality. And I remember going up to him and just saying like, thank you. Like, thank you for seeing like a vision, and being the guy to okay, because, you know, it's helped our family so much and really, you know, it has helped boxing in a way. Like, there was no numbers before that, but talk to us about that first fight, the flight out there, the computer, which I talked about a little bit on Chicken Talk too. And I posted it on Twitter as well, was this massive thing, like must've weighed 40 pounds. It was huge. This is before laptops. Take us through that first like trip out to Reno, and that night must've been pretty nerve wracking, but also exciting.
Too excited. Honestly, I was more excited than I wasn't really nervous. I just felt like, wow, you know, this is going to be fun. It wasn't so much fun lugging that computer around. Like you said, the thing had to weigh 40 pounds. We would take turns lugging it around the various airports. But the first fight, like I said, I really wasn't nervous. I was anxious to get it going, to get started with the fight. We had, you know, we had our headsets on and we did a rehearsal, and it was kind of like a surreal kind of feeling. You know, we were confident and we were excited, and it turned out to be a great fight too, because it was Bramble Mancini. Bramble had won the first fight. Mancini was such a fan favorite. The Reno Event Center, where the fight was, that probably with 12,000 in the building, they were all Mancini fans, so they were loud, really loud. And the way the fight played out, Mancini threw 100 something punches around. Man, Bramble had a style where he would have the earmuffs and he blocked a lot of the shots and would counter. He threw probably 800 but landed a higher percentage. Mm-hmm. You know, so right out of the gate, we were in the middle of a questionable decision, because some people thought Mancini won because he pressed the action. Bramble was the counter cleaner puncher. Bramble got the decision, and then we got the numbers actually got a great ride right after that fight, because there were boxing writers back then for newspapers. They're like, there had to be 20 or 25 writers at the fight, and they all ran with the numbers. So it was really exciting right from the get-go. We were just looking forward to our next show. There were never really any nerves, just excitement.
It was probably like you didn't realize what could go wrong. Like, you didn't understand. Like, now we know, like, if the program goes down or something, like we're thinking in our minds, in the back of our minds, like, you know, if something goes wrong, it's part of the job. We have to troubleshoot and it's live. Maybe like a little bit of ignorance is bliss type of thing, where it's like, all right, we're just here. Like, who knows what this can be? You know, you didn't have like the weight of the dependence on the service, right?
Well, we never thought about anything going wrong. Like, it was, like you said, it was ignorance is bliss. That computer had no battery backup. It just ran on a plug at ringside. So, which was taped down, like, you know, it was secured like Fort Knox.
Well, you love duct tape, so that doesn't surprise me.
Paul Hogarth, rest in peace, was the techie, and I made sure we taped that baby down. And they had the disk drives. It had no hard drive. We had a floppy disk drive. The program was on one drive. And if we ever lost that disk, we were screwed too, because we only had one at the time, one copy of it.
Well, and what happened if the computer didn't, like, what happens if something happened with the computer or it didn't like make it, or, you know, it luggage? I mean, you had to check the computer on flights. Like, it's not like you can go to Best Buy, like we've done that before, or if a computer craps out, or like go somewhere and get a new computer.
No, it would have been a big order. We never thought of that either. Eventually we did get a backup computer. Mm-hmm. We carried two computers, because one trip to London back in the day, I put the computer down to hail a taxi and someone stole it. It got ripped off right off the curb. And that was not a good feeling. So luckily we had a couple days before fight night, and we had another computer sent. That, like, they weren't easy to find though. The first one we bought it from some guy up on Long Island, but he told me something I never forgot. He said, redundancy, you gotta have backup. And yeah, it finally sunk in, like, you know, we should back the computer up, back up the disks. But at the time, we were like flying from the seat of our pants. So it was, you know, we never thought about what could go wrong. We were just happy to be there, I guess would be the word, because there was a big fights back then too. These weren't just, these weren't just weekly club shows we were doing. We did Larry Holmes and David Bay was our second fight. And the third fight, as I've said many times, was Hagler Hearns.
Wow. We'll get to that.
At Caesar's third fight in CompuBox history.
Yeah, so we'll get to that. But I remember the computer being so heavy, and like obviously all my brothers or the family weren't like allowed to even like go near it. Like, don't look at it. That's like it was almost like part of the family at some point. That's wild. Yeah. So the fourth fight or third fight was Hagler Hearns. And that's like a big theme of what I want to talk about, is being there for some of the biggest fights of all time. I mean, Hagler Hearns is like, will go down forever. I mean, still shared to this day on Twitter. People share it almost like, you see it like once a week. They post that first round. That must've been a wild night. And of course that first round, I still has some of the middleweight records are still established from that fight.
Yeah, it was, we knew that it was going to be a good fight because, I mean, it was Hagler, it was Hearns. It was the first trip to Vegas, Caesar's Palace. It was something, you as a kid, you're a young person, you see on TV. And I remember saying, I would love to get there someday for a fight. And little did I know, we'd be sitting ringside working an event like that. Again, it was all excitement leading up to the fight. It's a hot day, the sun went down behind the mountains, and boom, it's dusk, and it's Hagler Hearns, and then the bell rings in the first round. Marvin went straight at Hearns. Hearns, returned the favor, and they just threw down for 3 minutes straight. I remember the crowd going crazy. And I could hear them through my headset, the noise of the crowd roaring, standing roaring. And the round ends, and I look down and I see Hagler, 83 punches thrown, whatever it was, 50 something landed, no jabs. Wow. I'm like, oh my gosh, he didn't throw any jabs. And I look over at Logan's numbers, he had Hearns, 81 thrown, whatever landed. So that told me that, it was a hellacious round, nonstop punching, and we came through. We handed the stats were on the money for the amount of punches thrown and landed. So, and then the fight, went two more rounds, but, it's something that never forget. And it'll be hard to duplicate an event like that again.
Yeah, geez. I mean, I've seen some good ones in my short time, and it must be tough for you to try to compare something to that, but that's gotta be the moment where that was like, couldn't be in a better trial by fire. Because I've been there counting these punches live, and the crowd gets loud and emotions take over. We're all human. I said that too on Chicken Talk. I mean, we're all, just humans, like judges too. They get swayed, but for that is a different type of beast. That's Hagler Hearns. That's the 80s when boxing was at its highest, at its peak. That's a good trial by fire. And the numbers were on the money, because they weren't too crazy. I think it summed up exactly what went on in the ring that night. That must have been a wild one. So then from there, you guys felt like, you were established. You started to get more and more fights were starting to pile up there. And then I want to go to another super fight, and that is Leonard versus Hagler. And this was a question that was asked as well, was, do you guys work with any camps? And it's not something we do that much anymore, but it's something you guys did back then. I know that Ray Leonard had hired you guys to come up with a game plan to kind of beat Hagler. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, we knew that fight was in 87. We started in 85. So, and Ray Leonard at the time was working for HBO. He was an analyst. So we got to know him. He, you know, took an interest in the stats. And so did his manager at the time, Ollie Dunlop, was a pretty sharp guy as well. And they actually hired us to count some Hagler's past fights. I think we counted like 8 to 10 of his past fights. And then they brought us into his training camp in January in Maryland. The fight was in April. We came in January when he was doing, I think he sparred. It was 2 days of sparring. But the gist of it was that after breaking Hagler's numbers down, we found that he started slow. First four rounds, he would throw in the 50s, and then 5 through 8, he would crank it up, and then 9 through 12, he was his biggest output. So we prepared a breakdown for Ray and for Ollie Dunlop, and our suggestion to Ray, to the team, Leonard team, was to start fast. Don't give Marvin a chance to jump on you, especially being laid off for 3 years. Ray hadn't fought in 3 years. So for him to come out and be passive would not have been a good strategy. And also based on the fact that Marvin threw his fewest punches in those first four rounds, our suggestion was to come out and, you know, take it to Marvin, be the aggressor. And that's certainly what he did. And Marvin, sure enough, started slow. The first round, Marvin threw 16 punches.
Wow.
And afterwards, I remember talking to Ray, and he said he thought for sure that Marvin was going to jump all over him, come in the southpaw stance, crowd him, bully him, muscle him, throw him on the can, anything possible to throw Ray off his game. And Marvin came out in the orthodox stance and tried to box with Ray. Ray got in his head and stayed there. And, you know, the rest is history.
And he also would, I know he started quick, but he also did something at the end. I don't know if that was your suggestion or something that they came up with too, was that he would flurry at the end of every round and kind of give the judges, I mean, guys do that today all the time, but that's probably the most infamous or most notable time where you saw Leonard kind of flurry at the end of every round. That's probably one of the more debatable fights.
That's an old Muhammad Ali trick that Ray picked up.
Probably from Angelo Dundee, right?
Probably, yeah. Dundee and Ali Dunlop as well, where, you know, 30 seconds. If you watch that fight, you could hear Ali in the background, 30 seconds. And then Ray would flurry. Because the thinking is you give the judges, it stays fresh in the judges' mind. You know, they may have obviously watched the first 2.5 minutes of a round, but if it's close round, and a lot of those rounds were close, yeah, Ray would do a little shoe shine or, you know, pick up the pace over the last 30 seconds with hopes that, you know, he would, the round, that activity would stay fresh with the judges and get him the round if there was any doubt.
Yeah, and now that the numbers are so visible and they're out there a lot more, we don't really do that type of service. But I do get hit up a lot from trainers, some fighters. They want to know their opponent's punch numbers. They want us to work on send a report. But that must have been a pretty exciting time. But also kind of jumped over something, which was in 1985, and that's the rise of Mike Tyson. You were front and center for that. You were also there for the fall of Mike Tyson. You were there for the comeback of Mike Tyson. That must have been a wild time, not just to be like a boxing fan, just to be a sports fan, but the fact that you were there. What was your first recollection of Tyson?
That we were like in awe of him.
What was the first fight?
The first time we saw him was up in upstate New York. We didn't work the fight, but we went up to watch to see him. It was an ABC fight. Mm-hmm. And just the way his ring entrance, his aura was incredible. It's just something, and of course we were kind of new to being ringside as well. So I'd never seen anything like it. You know, on TV, you see certain fighters and they look intimidating, but to get into an actual venue, sit ringside, watch him, you know, coming in the ring with no robe, no socks, just straight fire, was intimidating. I could imagine what the opponent must have felt like. First fight we did, I think it was a fight in the garden. I don't recall who it was, Reggie Gross or something. I don't recall exactly who it was, but I do recall how fast his hands were for a heavyweight. He was one of the toughest guys to track, because you didn't know what he was going to throw. He worked off the jab, but then after that, you didn't know what he was going to throw. So you couple in the intimidation factor with the fast hands, and he was just something that, you know, that most people had never seen before, especially our generation of fight fans.
Yeah, it must have been something. I remember we had Joe Tessitore on the show, and he would go up there as well. You're probably in the same room with him. He's a little younger than you, but he would go out because the fights would be like Verona or somewhere. Yeah, he was fighting a lot upstate in the early days. He didn't even go by Iron Mike. I think he went by Kid Dynamite.
Like Albany, too. He fought up in the Albany area, Catskill area, because that's where Customato's home was. So he kept him busy up in that area, yeah.
So it must have been nuts to see, Tyson, between Tyson and 85, coming on the scene. And then you had the Four Kings. You had, Chavez Sr. Doing his thing, too. That was a great time in boxing. And you're right in the middle of it, CompuBox at that point. You're 3-4 years in. And then comes the 90s when the fall of Mike Tyson. You were there, Japan, for Mike Tyson versus Buster Douglas, which still, as of today, is one of the biggest upsets, not just in boxing, but all of sports. That had to have been an experience.
That was an odd, bizarre experience, because the fight started at 12 noon in Japan because HBO wanted to put it live in the States. So we got to work. It was 8 in the morning, I think, when we set up at ringside, and it was very quiet. I remember it. I remember looking around. I'm like, this place looks full, but why is it so quiet? The fight starts and the silence remains. We have the headset on. I can hear Douglas is beating Tyson like a drum, right? Really, from the first round on. Just landed punches, clean punches, and there's like no reaction from the crowd. The round would be over, and then you would get a polite applause from the Japanese fans. That's how they reacted to. Meanwhile, like you said, it's probably one of the biggest upsets in all of sports going down. And sure enough, when he finally knocked Tyson out, everybody was like in shock. And I remember sitting next to Evander Holyfield, because he was supposed to fight Tyson next. This fight with Buster Douglas was like a stay busy fight for Tyson. Don King, probably got an outrageous site fee from the Tokyo Dome to bring Tyson over there. And Douglas was always an iffy kind of fighter. When he was on, he was good, but most times he wasn't known, to give 100%. Well, this particular night, he fought the best fight of his life. And remember sitting next to Evander Holyfield, and he had this shocked look on his face, because there went, at the time, I think it was like $12 million payday down the drain, what they eventually did fight. But it was just a surreal evening from the beginning, because no one expected Douglas to beat Tyson the way he did. And like I said, the reaction when the crowd was like, it was like a little league baseball game. It was like, so it was a very bizarre evening, to say the least.
So just that puts kind of into perspective a little bit of the fact that you were there for Hagler Hearns, Leonard Hagler, Tyson Douglas, which, I mean, as a fight fan, I mean, those are ones that you would just dream about being at. And it's nuts.
And two months after Tyson Douglas, we were in Vegas for Chavez and Meldrick Taylor, which was another bond burner on regular HBO. I mean, so the boxing fans back then got Tyson Douglas and Chavez Meldrick Taylor in a 3-month span on regular HBO.
Yeah,
and
I that fight came up recently. We were talking about this past November how we had back to great fights, and I think someone on Twitter said, "Well, how about they? I'll one up you." Meldrick Taylor versus Chavez was like was it months or was it a few weeks after?
It was in March of 90. Yeah. So it was 2 months. It was 2 months after Tyson. No, it was a month after Tyson. Tyson was in February. It was a month later.
Wow.
In fact, they promoed Chavez Taylor on the Tyson Douglas coming up in March. Yeah. Like in another historic fight.
So by the time we're getting to the 90s now, and the heavyweights were big. And what was your recollection of that? I know you were there for Fan Man. You were there for the Bo Galata. I know these are like quirky moments, but I mean, that's like the, when I think of the early 90s from like 90 to 95, the first thing that comes to mind is the heavyweights.
It started with Lennox Lewis in the 88 Olympics. We were there in Korea when he won the gold medal. Mm-hmm. He beat Riddick Bowe actually in the gold medal match. And then they turned pro. And then they never fought as professionals, but then Bowe eventually won a heavyweight title. And that was another one of the more memorable fights was Bowe Holyfield won at the Thomas and Mack in Vegas. Nobody really knew. They knew who Bowe was, but Holyfield was, you know, was known as, you know, it was unbeatable at the time, seemingly unbeatable. Bowe came in great shape, actually fought more of a toe-to-toe fight than anyone expected. Bowe got the decision. And then they would fight two more fights after that. And then Lennox came along was dominated on his end. It's very unfortunate that him and Bowe never fought. But Lennox, you know, was dominant in his own right and eventually went on to fight Tyson. So, yeah, there were some great heavyweights, even Ray Mercer, Tommy Morrison, Michael Mora, Herbie Hyde. There's a long list of heavyweights in the 90s who get overlooked, who today would probably, you know, would be right at the top.
Yeah, I know.
These guys were overlooked because of Tyson, because of Lennox Lewis, because of Evander Holyfield, who actually started as a cruiserweight. Let's not forget that.
Well, you bring Holyfield. Up Tommy Morrison. You got to tell the story of when Michael Bent, who's been on our show before, knocked out Tommy Morrison, and then you were on a private plane with Bob Arum.
Yeah, well, Tommy Morrison had a signed contract to fight Lennox Lewis for like $10 million, but they talked him into defending his title like a hometown defense in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So they brought in Michael Bent, who, you know, was a decent puncher, but not known for having a great chin. So they figured that, you know, they get the payday and then move on to Lennox Lewis. So turns out that Bent knocks out Tommy Morrison in one round. So after the fight, Arum, we flew on a top-ranked jet because we had a show the next night in Arizona. So we're sitting in the back of the plane and somebody on the plane had a problem, needed to use the restroom. And on his way back, Arum says to the guy, here, use this to take care of business because it's useless. The, you know, the contract meant nothing now that Tyson and Lewis and Holyfield weren't going to meet. So it was just, you had to be there, but it was a hilarious line by Harry. You can use this. This contract is useless.
I use this to wipe.
Yeah. Use this to wipe, to put it mildly.
That's Arum for you. That's wild. Yeah. Those were the glory days of the heavyweights. And then by that time, you know, De La Hoya's on the scene. I'm going to jump ahead to Pacquiao.
Pernell Whitaker.
Those are all great moments in the early 90s. You know the timeline by now. And then I'm just trying to show the fans at home that are listening or are watching just like kind of the scope of how long you've been around the sport and how long CompuBox has been in it. It goes all the way back to Hagler Hearns and you go through that heavyweight era. You go through the Pernell Whitakers, you go Chavez to De La Hoya to Pacquiao to Mayweather to now, to this current era that we're in. And we have been along for the ride. You have been along for the ride. You've seen all different eras of boxing. You've seen all different rises and falls, as we just touched on. What would you say, like, how would you rate this era in terms of like the fighting style to what you've seen in the past?
there's a lot of good fighters around today. There's always guys in every weight class that probably would hold their own in any other era, but not as many of them. There's not as deep as it was back in the day. And I think part of the reason for that is they just don't fight enough today. These guys fight maybe two fights a year, and they don't have the extensive amateur background that these guys had either back in the 80s and 90s. Because the amateur program isn't what it once was. So they're kind of pushed along. You know, there's great fighters. A great fighter is a great fighter. Guys like Boots Ennis, you know, Crawford, Spence, they would have held their own, I think, in any era. But back then, there was more good fighters. I mean, we worked these top rank series on ESPN. It started in 89, and we worked it right through almost to 2000. Top Rank was with ESPN. And week after week, we saw, you know, solid fights. So there was a deeper roster of fighters back then. Today, yeah, there's a lot of good fighters, but not as many. And it comes from, I think, from basically from a weaker amateur system, and they just don't fight as frequently today because of, you know, the politics of the game.
Yeah, it is a little troubling to if you think about it. And that's true, because Friday night fights went off the air, I know that wasn't exactly the Top Rank thing, but I think it somehow evolved from the Top Rank deal into Friday Night Fights. And that left a big void. I mean, I know a lot of fight fans were upset when that went off the air, because it was every week. It wasn't like the biggest of shows. It wasn't, didn't have a huge budget. It wasn't huge main events, but it just like, it was like the minor leagues in a way. It was like, you know, it was developmental. You need that. And I do agree that the amateur system is not what it once was. Pandemic certainly hasn't helped in terms of grassroots shows. You know, Lou DeBell is a good friend of ours, and you know, he hasn't been able to put on consistent shows at the club level. So the younger guys who are making their debuts, who are fighting these 4 and 6, 8 rounders, are not getting any work. So it's scary a little bit, because you think about it, and there's no, like, it's not like a league where there's a minor leagues and you have a set of schedules. It's kind of, everyone's kind of all on their own there.
Yeah, it's the separate platforms now. You know, as you know, there's the Zone, there's ESPN, there's Fox. Yeah, I mean, hopefully that'll change as time goes on. Maybe one of these, it's possible a platform will drop out and they'll incorporate with another and keep these guys busier too. Another thing too, with the Top Rank back in the day, one thing about, they matched these fighters tough, like Ron Katz and Bruce Trample back then. They got, if you talk to Katz, he'll tell you, he got many a contender knocked off because of the Top Rank series on ESPN. They had a certain level of fights. And like you said, this is what the fans look forward to. They knew you were going to get solid fights every week. It wasn't the A side versus the B side, where you knew A was going to, you know, take out the B side in a matter of minutes. So, you know, it was a good time, and it actually developed fighters more. And they always came out with a good B side opponent for these top guys back then too. You knew who these guys were by the time they got their title shot, because they had fought 2-3 times a year on ESPN. And that, again, that's something that doesn't happen that frequently today. Hopefully that'll change.
Yeah, I would say Golden Boy is the closest to that, to this current day. I think they do a good job of matching tough, because, you know, they almost have to. They don't have a huge roster. I agree. That's certainly missing today. But 35 plus years of CompuBox. I work for the company. Our Nick, my brother, your son, works for the company. You got a big family. Did you ever envision when that first meeting with Ross Greenberg to Bramble Mancini, to all these fights in between till now, did you ever think it would make it this far? Or did you think you'd have such an impact on the sport?
No, I know. I didn't have that kind of vision. We were more concerned about, you know, putting out the best product week to week you know, and just keep grinding. You know, it was always there was always a little bit of criticism about the numbers. So it just kind of drove me to, you know, stay on the top of my game and always try to put out the best product. And so far it's worked that way. And yeah, it's put all five children through college, right? You guys, you and Nick are now involved on a day-to-day basis with the company. We have a nice lifestyle here out on Long Island. So no, I never envisioned it, but I'm very grateful that, you know, things worked out the way they did, and that it's become a, you know, a family affair. It's I couldn't have asked for anything more, especially for a sport that I, you know, grew up loving the sport of boxing. So to make a career out of something that I was a fan of was, again, it's something that you just can't, it's hard to envision something like that going down, but here we are talking about it. So, you know, it's been a great ride. And I would thank your mother for that too, because she's the one that held the fort down over the years when I would be traveling. I mean, some weeks it was, we had ESPN and HBO on the same weekend. And your mother held the fort down, and I got to give her all the credit as well. Because without her support, we probably wouldn't be talking about 35 plus years of CompuBox. So again, it's been a family affair.
She might burst through the door right now and say thank you. But yeah, that's right. I can confirm that. You were gone a lot of weekends, but you always made up for it during the week. And that just was part of the gig back then. It was a lot. You had to do that, pay your dues. You had to travel all over. We didn't have a full squad or team going there. I do remember that as a kid, being on the road a lot. And then us going to fights and stuff and having those perks, you know, growing up sitting on George Foreman's lap, or getting to know Jim Blampley, or as the years went on, you know, watching Roy Jones fight a lot. He was, you know, probably the most featured HBO guy. So that was always a big trip for us as kids. And then also like the Friday night fights, you know, going to like a Reading, Pennsylvania, a Mystic, Connecticut. Those were always fun.
Blue Horizon. I think you got to see the Blue Horizon, yeah, which was a legendary place. It was 110 degrees the one night I took you and your brother, Robbie.
Yeah.
We got to see some good club shows as well.
And now it goes right up till current day where I get to go do it. And it just feels like, you know, it's like a natural thing. When I'm in ringside for a fight, it feels like it's chaotic. It's very, you bring someone to a fight for the first time, they're kind of shell shocked, but it's strange because when I sit ringside, I feel the most like calm because I've been around it since, you know, I came out of the womb. So yeah. It's been a good ride. It's been a great show. I appreciate you coming on, Bob. Dad, boss, what do I call you here? But I appreciate it.
Master.
We'll be back next week with another edition of Inside Boxing Live. We'll be previewing Keith Thurman versus Mario Barrios. We'll see you next week.